Now, as most of you know, of course, there are, and we have seen it since yesterday, in fact, there are never any debates about the question of who or what has more standing among small philosophers, and in fact also liberationists of varied persuasions. In recent times, I think much of this has been triggered by political arguments over the rights or lack thereof of non-human sentient animals, as well, of course, as questions about human fetuses and embryos. Proponents of the view that sentient, non-human animals have defensible moral rights claims defend their stance typically by arguing that these animals can be wronged in morally relevant ways by moral agents like ourselves because they have interests that are the results of certain capacities like our own. So typically then, what motivates rights claims and claims of moral standing are particular capacities by animals that are like ours. And given that it's only fair to treat like alike or to give equal consideration to something that is relevantly equal, it's defensible to argue that, for instance, sentient animals should be treated in a manner that is comparable to sentient humans, at least as far as the infliction of pain and suffering is concerned. So everything hinges here then on a non-human entity having capacities that are comparable to our own. The idea essentially is this: I can experience pain, which typically leads to suffering. A given sentient non-human animal has the same capacity or a similar capacity. It responds, in fact, to pain-inducing stimuli in a manner similar to how I would respond. I and humans like me prefer to avoid pain and suffering. So the assumption is that these sentient non-human animals respond to pain-inducing stimuli, like us, they try to avoid them, suggests that, like us, they prefer not to experience that. So the infliction of pain and suffering, then, on these sentient non-human animals appears not to be a morally neutral activity. And so, seeing that because it inflicts pain and suffering on them and so results in us harming them if we do so regardless. Based on the variety of this argument, many ascribe moral standing to sentient non-human animals. But why does it matter really who we ascribe moral standing to? And I think you might be able to get a good indication of the significance of the answers to these kinds of questions by undertaking a search in your favorite online search engine, such as, for instance, Google Scholar. A lot of people have a lot of different ideas about the question of who or what has moral standing. So what I wanted to start off with was just to clear a little bit of ground, and this was in my own mind when I started writing this, to explain how I understand moral standing. It seems to me, at least, and this is not totally controversial what I'm saying here, whoever has moral standing is somebody who can be morally wronged by actions undertaken by moral agents. A moral agent is someone who has the capacity to distinguish between what is morally right and what is morally wrong. So if you have moral standing and I'm a moral agent, my actions affecting you can be morally right, wrong, or neutral. If something has no moral standing, whatever it is that I do or don't do to it that affects it has no moral implications. So if we agree then that a stone has no moral standing, me kicking the stone along the road is morally inconsequential, at least as far as the stone and as far as the universe is concerned. So if you think then that non-human animals or people with certain disabilities or androids have no moral standing, your treatment of them, whatever you might choose to do or not to do, would, all other things being equal, a morally neutral activity. Alan Buchanan has suggested that we should distinguish between moral status and moral standing. To him, saying that something has moral standing simply means that it counts morally in its own right. However, the moral status of entities that have moral standing might not necessarily be the same. And this is then when we can get into these hierarchies, if you want to, you know, that people have discussed here. And this probably is in line with the kind of hierarchy of ranking that Ruth and Tom tried to get worked out by means of their large grant. Now, some beings with moral standing might have a higher or lower moral status than other beings who have also moral standing. And in brackets, as far as I can see, again, this depends entirely on how they relate to our own capacities. Nothing else counts. It just doesn't happen in our universe of analysis. So we can then have any number of arguments about the normative grounds on which we could base such rankings. But it's not unheard of in moral philosophy that sentient persons are seen as having a higher status than sentient non-persons. Why is that? Because they are paradigmatic human beings. They are like us. And of course, as Sarah explained in response to Michael's question yesterday, they had to be on the top of our pecking order, of the greasy pole of moral status. And this seems, not surprisingly, I think, to align with more intuitions that many of us share. Because this approach could, for instance, lead us to grant sentient non-human animals moral standing and moral status. Conceding this would still permit us then, as we have seen here, to disagree vigorously about the question of whether a non-human animal's moral status should be the same as that of a human being with similar intellectual capacities or that of a person. What seems uncontroversial to Buchanan is that moral status admits of degrees. Marianne Warren, in her book on moral status, Obligations to Persons and Other Living Things, on the other hand, seems to propose that we should use moral status and moral standing interchangeably, because to have moral status is to be morally considerable or to have moral standing. And yet she still finds herself in the business of wanting to create pecking orders. And so, in fact, does Wayne Sumner, to whom sentient is both a necessary and sufficient condition for establishing moral status. Status comes here in degrees depending on the being's capacity for sentience. So flies would find themselves lower in the pecking order than pigs, and if you asked me to join a camp, I would probably get a membership card for Sumner's camp. But of course, where personhood should trump sentience is never quite clear, except when we realize that those who make those determinations are people who happen to be also persons. So it probably can't hurt then to place oneself on top of whatever pecking order one creates, and we are very good at that. Now, if we take the debate about sentient non-human animals as our starting point, it becomes clear that many of the arguments about moral standing as well as moral status rely strongly, if not entirely, on drawing parallels from human capacities and needs that we have to those of sentient non-human animals who seem to have comparable, if not identical, needs. The content of this moral standing is inconceivable without us as humans having experienced something that demands particular consideration of our needs. And we grant the existence of those needs to sentient non-human animals that seem to have similar needs. Their moral standing, in other words, depends entirely on our experiential world. They would be otherwise irrelevant. We would have nothing to go by, to even look at them, evaluate, nothing. After all, when you think about it, most of us are typically not at all concerned about the moral standing of inanimate objects, such as stones and rocks. And I wonder whether that is not indicative of our failure to imagine anything that is not somehow, somewhat, like us and our experiential world. And David Hume was right, of course. Our moral feelings, as he put it, make up the essential and instinctive foundations of our morality. But that's an issue I want to return to in just a moment. Now let's talk about what I think are the easy bits. When you think about chimeras, for instance, there's been some excited reporting recently about the injection of reprogrammed human-derived stem cells from patients with Parkinson's disease into the brains of monkeys. Concerns have been raised on the one hand about the well-dissected ethics, of animal experimentation involving monkeys. Invariably, if one is opposed to the creation and use of monkeys for research purposes, one will be opposed to such projects. However, arguments also began evolving around the question of whether the insertion of human cells into these monkeys' brains should be seen as meaningfully impacting on the moral status of these non-human animals. So if we had pegged their moral standing at, say, 67 out of 100, or 5 billion, however many trillion, whatever you want to put it, but say we put it at 67 out of 100 for the sake of the argument, 100 being, of course, a paradigmatic human person, based on their being sentient beings with limited intellectual capacities, would then the insertion of those human cells move them higher up on the greasy pole of moral status? Would they be more human as a result of this and so move up the moral status pecking order? Pig human chimeras have also been produced with a view to creating organisms that can be utilized for organ transplantation purposes. As before, some will be opposed to the use of sentient non-humans as involuntary spare organ banks for human purposes. And the question arises here, of course, at what point in time the pig human chimera might be transformed into a human pig chimera, and whether eventually it might turn into a human, depending on how far we might be able to advance such development projects. Would such changes impact meaningfully on the entity's moral state standing or status? And bioethicists have worked their way, I think, successfully through standard fair ethical objections to creating such chimeras, debating the supposed unnaturalness of the procedures leading to chimeras. There were endless varieties of slippery slope arguments along Frankenstein's scenarios. concerns about violations of species integrity, and if all else fails, that bioethical all-time classic free for all human dignity. So it seems to me as if arguments about the moral status and moral standing of such chimeras are not terribly complicated to settle. Well-known positions developed in the context of the animal rights debates are applicable here, and David in particular has nicely described a thing and analyzed in his book, Taking Animals Seriously, the relevant marker events that we could look up in this context. From nociception, consciousness, pain, distress, fear, anxiety, suffering, pleasure, enjoyment, happiness, desires, concepts, beliefs, and so on and so forth. Now, while there's no consensus over the question of which of these marker events is the relevant one, I'm talking like with a weird accent at the moment, I apologize. So while there's no consensus over the question of which of these marker events is the relevant one, what is it today? Or whether a single one of these events constitutes a Trump-type inflection point from which everything changes, the arguments are well familiar. Only to speciesists, really, will the question of when chimeras are sufficiently close to our species that they should attain full moral status cause some headaches. To sentientists like Wayne Sumner, for instance, at UFT, University of Toronto, that is an irrelevant consideration. To defenders of a subject of a life standard like Tom Regan, this would also be an irrelevance. In any case, I think that with the exception of speciesists whose stance I think is implausible, there's little that can be said beyond the well-established arguments from the animal rights debates in this context. People agree on criteria that can be defended, even if we hold diverging views on which of these criteria we consider to be the right ones. What these criteria have in common, however, is that their starting point is some arguably physiologic equivalency to a paradigmatic human's capacities. It doesn't matter then whether you settle for Bentham Singer's sentientism or Regan's more complex subject of a life criterion. Both standards are inconceivable without the human condition that gave rise to them. The starting point was us. Our ability to experience pain and suffer, our dispositional capacity to be subjects of our lives, and so on and so forth. So this approach works well with regard to whatever kind of entity that possesses arguably the ability to experience experiences like paradigmatic humans do. Now, the older folks amongst us might recall Data. Data is a fictional character in the science fiction series Star Trek. Data is a highly sophisticated android with human-like characteristics, including, strangely, having a sex. Data the machine, well, hopefully at least, these days I'm not so certain anymore, but hopefully uncontroversially, Data is male. In various episodes of the series, he seems to regret his inability to experience emotions, including joy. Well, regret, in fact, might be too strong a label. It's more like a curious befuddlement. In the feature film Star Trek First Contact, I hope you have seen it. If not, just assume there was this movie called Star Trek First Contact. There's this evil Borg queen. Well, some of you are smiling here, and the rest, I lost you probably. In any case, so in this feature film Star Trek First Contact, the evil Borg queen offers Data what he desires. She reconfigures the android so that he also experiences emotions, as well as sensation. Skin crafts are thrown in for good measure. So this takes us, of course, then to the challenging ethical question about the moral standing and status of potential future artificial intelligence entities created by us, or potentially at some point created by themselves, that might display characteristics and behaviors similar to our own. Data, for instance, has a line in one of the series episodes where he says, and I quote Data, no kidding, "I chose to believe that I was a person and that I had the potential to become more than a collection of circuits and subprocessors," unquote. The riposte in this episode is delivered by Beverly Crusher, in brackets if you don't know her, she's the Starship's doctor. And she says, "Commander Data, the android who sits here at ops operations dreams of being human, but he never gets the punchline to a joke," unquote. So while he failed as the pre-upgraded Data to relate to humans and so satisfy Rob Sparrow, about whom we will hear more in just a moment, everything changed in terms of his moral status and moral standing after that was done. Once he had the emotion chip installed and the skin graft that permitted him to feel sensation, he really was like us in morally relevant ways. What is about relevant, anyway? His status, arguably, should have been pegged somewhere above us, due to his superior analytical skills and speed, as well as his bodily strength. And that perhaps was the Star Trek writer's answer to the question of what constitutes consciousness. Now, the troubling thing about post-Borg Queen Data is that we still had to take at face value his expressions of anxiety, stress, fear, and so on and so forth. But we didn't know, not in that series, and we could never know, really, how the skin graft, emotion chip, and his Android hardware actually interacted. Was that really the same as us experiencing anxiety, stress, fear, and so on and so forth? Thankfully, until to date, there are no androids developed anywhere near to a level where a data-like scenario would even occur as a serious question. However, if we ever reached a stage where creatures like Cylons, cybernetic life form nodes, Cylons, could become a reality, that is where we would debate the moral standing or status of bioengineered hybrids of humans and machines. This empirical question would pose a very serious challenge to address indeed. And the main reason for this is that we typically take expressions of pain, suffering, and happiness at face value. We can never know, ultimately, whether someone who expresses pain, suffering, or happiness actually experiences any of those. One of the first things that medical students are taught is to believe their patients when they claim that they are in pain. This is so because, despite a few gotcha strategies, we have no means to investigate the veracity of such patients' claims. We act on our own experience of those feelings and assume that someone who is physiologically close to us can experience the same. So our existing ethical analysis then, unless they are species, then I would put it to you that they still are species, even if you add sentientism, because there's nothing else that we do, that we can do probably, rely on the truth of those assumptions. So I think it's not too far-fetched then to grant the truth of such assumptions with regard to beings that are in vital respects like us, as biological chimeras could arguably be. But where would that leave Data, an android-human hybrid? And my response to this would be that we would need to research the empirical questions of whether what Data claims he feels is something that he actually feels in a manner that is similar to us. At least we have something we could compare under those circumstances. If the answer to the empirical question then is yes, we can deploy our established modes of ethical analysis to address questions of moral status, standing, but perhaps more importantly, questions of our moral obligations. So I'm very grateful to Ruth and Tom for working this out for us during the grand project, because I'm genuinely curious, and in brackets, I don't know whether it's possible actually to get these answers at all, but who knows. But let's assume the answer is no, or quite possibly maybe. Where would that leave us? And here's what I think are the more difficult bits. Self-learning artificial intelligence machines like androids, for instance. There's quite a bit of literature that exists on the ethical implications of creating and eventually interacting with self-learning artificial intelligence. And let me note in passing, at least, that I'm somewhat less excited about the challenges these machines cause in terms of their moral status and standing, even though these questions are fascinating. I'm much more anxious as a science fiction fan and with reference to Terminator, Battlestar Galactica, and Star Trek, certainly. I'm much more concerned about the question of whether they will eventually consider us humanoids as imperfect to be eradicated carbon-based life forms, as V'ger pointed out in its Ilya probe in Star Trek, or as having moral status and as deserving to survive when AI machines eventually will take over. Now, you might recall that the Cylons, both in the 2003 miniseries as well as the 2004 Battlestar Galactica, where we were thought of as sinful and flawed and to be eradicated. Now, these were religiously fanatic machines, but they were still crazy. In any case, the question of moral status and moral standing seems quite significantly more difficult vis-a-vis self-learning artificial intelligent machines, such as, for instance, androids like the pre-upgrade Data, who didn't have the emotion chip. So for the purpose of ease, I will henceforth refer to androids, but please interpret this as any kind of self-learning artificial intelligence machine that does not have the uncontroversial physiologic capacity to feel pain. It doesn't have it because, unlike post-upgrade Data and unlike the humanoid Cylons, there is no biological component that could give rise to the kind of pain and suffering as we understand it when we consider higher mammals or equivalent life forms. So what would be the situation vis-à-vis intelligence as a marker event of personhood? Rob Sparrow, some of you might be familiar with his work. He's back at Monash, isn't he? Okay. He has argued years ago, when I didn't even think about any of these issues, he has argued for a Turing triage type test to assist us in determining whether an artificial intelligence possesses moral standing. Now, as we have heard, I think Walter did it, the original Turing test, of course, had a different function. Here, the objective was simply to test whether an android could manage to talk in such a way that a human unaware that they were talking to the android could be fooled into thinking that they were talking to conversing with a fellow adult human. Turing was in no doubt in his days already that machines eventually would be able to succeed on that frontier, and indeed, an artificial intelligence machine reportedly successfully passed the Turing test in 2014. Now, Sparrow's Turing triage type test is somewhat different that he proposes. He proposes instead, and I quote, a test for when computers have achieved moral standing by asking when a computer might take the place of a human being in a moral dilemma, such as a triage situation in which a choice must be made as to which of two human lives to save. We will know, he says, that machines have achieved moral standing comparable to a human when the replacement of one of these people with an artificial intelligence leaves the character of the dilemma intact, unquote. And Sparrow has little doubt. If we decide that moral personhood is only a matter of cognitive skills, it's just a matter of time until artificial intelligence attains moral standing. I think he's right there. Sparrow instead is defending an account of moral standing where, for a machine to pass a Turing test, it must be capable of being the object of remorse, grief, and sympathy, as small emotions such as these are partially constitutive of our concept of a person, he says. And then he goes on, but I claim, machines are not appropriate, surprise, it's Rob Sparrow after all, but I claim, machines are not appropriate objects of these responses because they're incapable of achieving the individual personality to which they're oriented, unquote. So it seems to me then that moral standing for Sparrow entails crucially being part of a network of others like us with whom we socially interact, like for instance in the African philosophy of Ubuntu. And machines, he's right, up to a point. Today, in any case, would have some difficulty passing such a test. He eventually admits that his analysis boils down to something more trivial. It goes back to our intuitions about what such machines can and can't do, as opposed to what they might, at a certain point in time, they de facto can't or can do. He writes, we cannot seriously hold that machines have thoughts or feelings or an inner life because a radical doubt inevitably arises as to whether they really feel what they appear to. And that's the crux of it. We will never know, probably. Unquote. Now, Descartes would have offered similar thoughtful thoughts vis-à-vis non-human higher mammals in his days. Descartes was clearly wrong. The jury's out there on Sparrow. Time will tell. If I had to place a bet, I would bet that Sparrow would eventually be proven wrong, too. I'm skeptical that Sparrow's social relationship strategy is helpful. It encounters problems of the same kind that we are familiar with from the animal rights debates. There will be humans who are unable or unwilling to reciprocate socially in social relationships or to participate in such relationships. Surely their moral standing or moral status cannot be contingent on their recognition by others. Why should someone's moral standing depend on whether they succeed in becoming the object of our remorse, grief, or sympathy? If we have learned anything from Descartes' failure to recognize animal pain and animal suffering, it's this. We are, as a species, not sophisticated enough to do justice even to others who are, in fact, uncontroversially like us in morally relevant ways, let alone to others who are very much unlike us. So leaving aside relational approaches to moral status or moral standing, it seems to me that two questions arise, one of which seems to be empirical in nature, the other one in normative in nature. I will give answers to both of these questions. I think both of my answers are pretty crappy, and I'm kind of curious whether you have better answers. So the empirical question is this. If androids expressed the experience of pain and suffering, happiness and misery, what would they actually experience, if anything? Is it comparable to what we would experience? Is it comparable to what, say, higher non-human mammals might experience? In case we're able to defend an affirmative answer to these questions, we would be able to deploy the same type of analysis that we have been going over and over since yesterday here. And so we would be able actually to make sense of this in terms of ethical analysis. And in some senses would be good news, given that it's well-trodden territory. We would be able to bring to bear sophisticated ethical frameworks to this question. And I've alluded to this already in the section on chimeras. The trouble is, of course, we currently do not have the means to make a definite determination. And Sperr's answer is quite revealing again. They ain't like us, therefore it ain't happening. He might be right today, he might be wrong tomorrow. And this takes me to the other question. I think it's crucial and it's normative. What if the empirical question is answered in the negative? Like, it's not like us. We have no evidence that there is real pain. We have no evidence that there is real suffering. We have no evidence that there is real regret, no matter what they tell us. Would that give us more license to discard an Android's expression of suffering? And we should finally address the elephant in the room. Is it normatively defensible to reduce answers to the question about moral status and moral standing to essentially criteria that look exclusively at the human experience and exclude everything that falls outside the realm of moral consideration, as we are doing so far? And that pretty much is Sperr's response. But the same holds true, of course, for sentientism-based approaches, and it falls short, I think, of what is morally required. It doesn't take us long to realize that our current strategy, namely to make us the standard of evaluating anything else, is difficult to defend. And bear with me if I come up one more time with a science fiction example. So imagine there's an extraterrestrial species visiting us. It's not completely out of the possibility. It might happen at some point. So they visit us. On leaving their spaceship, they make particular requests vis-a-vis their accommodation. They request a particular low temperature, and they require a large energy source to regenerate during and after our meetings. As hosts, we are provided by them with the necessary specifications for the hardware. They also kindly eventually provide us with some hardware because our adapters apparently are incompatible. Eventually, they leave their spaceship. Well, they materialize in our meeting room, bringing along their own energy source to ensure they have sufficient regeneration capability until their bodies and our energy sources have been made compatible. Our service androids provide the human species representative with sustenance during the meeting. There's quickly an exchange of information occurring between the extraterrestrials and our service androids. The extraterrestrials, much like European politicians would do in business meetings with Chinese or Arab counterparts, bring up the issue of android rights. And based on what they gathered from our androids, what they perceive to be abuse and discriminatory conduct by humans towards those machines, because we have made already our determination that none of that counts. Essentially, they charge these extraterrestrials that we had ignored unfairly the androids' demands for reliable energy supply, appropriate temperature, and worse, timely repairs, both in their work and their out-of-service environment. So it is true that androids did complain about these three issues, and about the temperature in particular to us. But we were very quick to reject those complaints on the grounds that androids cannot suffer. As far as we were concerned, the androids were faking it. And they cited Sperr's work quite approvingly, apparently. It was also cheaper to do so, and in this future society, capitalism still reigns. So the extraterrestrials wouldn't accept any of these explanations. While they can't experience pain or suffering or happiness, they bring us the example of cheap labor that they have imported to their home world. These biological organisms are in fact not dissimilar to us, in that they require sustenance, rest, they are sentient by our definition of sentience. And while the extraterrestrials can't experience any of these things, they did listen to the complaints that they received when the first cohort of workers got weaker and weaker due to the lack of available food. They realized quickly that their standards of well-being were quite different to that of those laborers. And they realized that they could not apply their own standards of well-being to them. Their needs were different. Now, I grant you, of course, that this is all completely made up. It's far-fetched as far as hypotheticals go. But I do think that it goes to show maybe that our strategy, namely to using our own experience that we are familiar with as the gold and the only standard, might be impossible to defend when it's challenged. Different beings will have different needs. So as far as their moral standing or moral status is concerned, any attempt at making a determination should be uniquely different to that we deployed in the case of non-human animals, insofar as there doesn't have to be biological material directly involved in the production of artificial intelligence machines. And yet they show dispositional capacities that seem comparable, if not identical, to some human dispositional capacities that typically give rise to claims about moral status and moral standing. So part of the difficulty we face will undoubtedly be to answer the question of whether hypothetical human or sentient being-like responses to particular stimuli in an artificial intelligence entity are morally equivalent to the responses given by beings that we think we know, are physiologically capable of having such experiences. And if they are not, well, that would give us moral license to ignore them. So let me wrap this up by talking briefly about the secret lives of stones. An obvious response to my hypothetical is that there are no such extraterrestrials. There's no evidence that there are beings who can be wronged who are not, at a minimum, sentient. It's all nice and well to go on harping about the Borg Queen and Data or Cylons when they also do not exist. And I concede that. I'm not proposing that we grant rights to particular operating environments or treatments to current-day androids. But that is only because they have not yet reached the stage of sophistication where that seems warranted. In a way, they are like stones that we kick down the road or like milkshakes that protesters share with Nigel Farage. The reason why we do not grant rocks and stones particular rights to be left alone, that is, lying forever where they are, is perhaps not only because they have no interest that we can wrap our heads around for the reasons that I mentioned, but also because they have never made any effort to communicate their violated or threatened interests. So to be fair to those who think that I'm too conservative here and that we should go further, there are in fact precedents supportive of their stance already in our legal systems. To give you an example, we create legal rights today, not only to persons and quasi-persons like corporations, for instance, but also innate things like rivers, for instance. Some of you will be familiar with the Whanganui River in New Zealand, which has been granted the same rights as persons. It must be treated by law as a living entity, even though clearly it is not. When I say clearly it is not, based on what we know, and we might be mistaken. The reason for this is that the Maori hold a worldview where the river is considered a living entity with valid moral claims and valid moral standing, and ultimately the political campaign succeeded. This is what happened. Now, I think of rivers as ecosystems with instrumental value that should give rise to certain protections. But unless one subscribes to worldview that William Frankenau has described as a holistic environmental ethic, where everything somehow counts, it would not be because it deserves those protections in its own right, that is, in the absence of it being of instrumental value. Interestingly enough, this holistic ethic fails to address our standard lifeboat example, and you can just think about it. Say you have, in this example, where basically everything in the environment somehow matters, has some standing. Say you have 5 billion cancer cells in one person with cancer. Who matters more? How do you quantify that? There's nothing at all in this ethic that would answer this question. But what about the future? What about future post-upgrade data equivalent androids? My view would be this. Unlike Sparrow, I would not want to eliminate such a possibility of valid interests that is specific to future sophisticated androids. But I can't envisage it beyond hypotheticals that have currently at least no relation whatsoever to reality. Far-fetched as the hypothetical with the visiting extraterrestrial was, it points us to something that might be relevant, though. If there is a sophisticated android, say a machine with no biologic components at all, that feels wronged by our treatment of it, we will need some evidence or argument from it or from a proxy defending it that shows evidence in support of the violated interest or harm claims. It's easier, I think, for us to investigate claims of harm if there's a biological being that is somewhat familiar to us. It's harder, if not impossible, for us to investigate such claims if there's no biological component that offers us a chance to compare like with like and draw conclusions from that. So I think it's not unreasonable to place the onus on something that claims rights for itself on the claimant or the human proxy, as has been the case with non-human animals or the river in New Zealand. In our history, at least, rights activism ultimately led to desirable societal change, whether it was for people who were held as slaves, women, queer people, or animals. They made their case, or we made their case, depending on how you want to read this. We made our case, sometimes by deploying militant means, and we succeeded. At a minimum, I would expect androids to make their case, to stake their claim. Now, one could object that androids might not have the capacity to do so themselves. And again, I think the case of the Whanganui River is illuminating. The case there was brought by the Maori people, acting on the river's behalf. So one could easily imagine human proxies representing the androids too. Say the Android Liberation Front, something like that. I don't think it's unreasonable to say that if something that might have justifiable moral claims against small agents is unable to communicate those claims, and these claims are so significantly different to what we know today that we can't imagine them, we are not quite blameworthy for not recognizing our failings. And this seems a reasonable response, maybe not. To me, it looks like a reasonable response to the conundrum of wanting to do justice to something that might be, but that we haven't seen yet, and that would be very different to us. It's also easier than to conjure up justifications for interests that would be significantly different to our own, and that it's nigh to impossible, in fact, to conceptualize such claims today. In the meantime, what I think it's worth reconsidering is whether sentientism or personhood or variations of them really should be the only games in town. And I have no answer, by the way, it's not a rhetorical question. I would not be able to say yes or no. I'm just uncertain at this stage, that's all. Science fiction does give us surprisingly rich fodder for analysis, and it might prepare us for things to come. So thanks very much for your time.